listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The five-concert series starts this month, Saturday, February 19th, with Robin and Linda Williams.
Gonna drink sweet honey whiskey.
Give me a good heavy load. Clear stretch of road, and I'll let that old bulldog run.
The Portland Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
The President of the United States is the most powerful figure in the world, so living up to the prestige of the office is serious business, but that doesn't stop presidents from committing their fair share of gaffes.
Whoops. Oh, goodness.
And so, in my speech to the nation.
That's a great asset. More inflation. What a stupid son of a.
After all, presidents are humans just like you and me.
I think by deflating my kind of idea of these heroic presidents, it let me see all of them as humans. Some who were very good humans with some flaws, some who were deeply flawed with a few good points.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today, the office of the presidency through the lens of modern art and creative prose. Question: what do former President Dwight D. Eisenhower and Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz have in common? I'll give you a hint.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Yes, they're both from Kansas. That fun fact actually inspired one of Colin Rafferty's essays in his new book called Execute the Office. It's an experimental, genre-busting collection of essays he wrote on every U.S. president. Colin is an English professor at the University of Mary Washington. Colin, of all the subjects to write about, how did it come to be that you're writing about presidents? They just don't seem to lend themselves to a collection of essays.
It came out of a desire to experiment with nonfiction. I moved to Virginia in 2008 to begin teaching nonfiction writing at the University of Mary Washington, and it was a presidential election. And in fact, for the first time, Virginia was in play in a long time. And so I found myself kind of surrounded by all these presidential happenings, both historical and contemporary. At the same time, I was looking to do something experimental with nonfiction writing. A lot of nonfiction writing at the time that was experimental or lyric in nature was memoir-based. And I think that was because people felt like they could be experimental if they were writing about their own lives, if they were on that kind of solid ground of knowing exactly what they were writing about because it had happened to them. And I wanted to try to do something else, to try to expand that world. And so I thought, well, what if I wrote essays that were lyric in nature, that took chances in form and in structure and in content, but were also eminently fact-checkable? And so I thought, well, okay, if there's a way to do this, you know, I'll need a lot of subjects, and the president seemed like, you know, by virtue of living in Virginia, a kind of ready-made subject.
Was there one where you took those chances and experimentation that really worked?
There was one that I really loved that didn't make it into the final book. It was the original version of the Calvin Coolidge essay. And Coolidge, if anybody knows anything about Coolidge, it's this story about how he was so reticent and so I think hated speaking so much that at a party or a reception, two women came up to him and said, "Mr. President, I have a bet with my friend that I can get you to say three words." And Coolidge said, "You lose." And I thought, okay, this is great. What if I wrote an essay about Coolidge that was entirely in two-word fragments?
Do you have it with you, even though it didn't make it into the actual book?
Oh, sure. Yeah, give me a second to pull it up here. I was looking for literary magazines to send essays to, and there was one magazine that sent out a call for submissions for wildly experimental work. And I thought, okay, I've got this Coolidge essay that feels wildly experimental. I'll send it to them. And so I sent it to them and got a response back from the editor a few months later that was, "I know I asked for experimental work, but this is too much."
Yeah.
And I have always kind of carried that as a badge of honor. So here's the first paragraph of it. So it's called "You Lose." And just imagine a page full of two-word quotes. "What can he say? He says the oath. At midnight, President Harding, newly dead, he stands, family room, and swears the oath. Faithfully execute, best ability, preserve, protect, defend, etc. You know the rest." And so his father, notary public, has made him president. And so it's that kind of constant just start, stop that I think drove that editor to say, "Look, I asked for experimental, but not this."
You have so much great experimental in here. The one you did on Dwight Eisenhower, mm-hmm, is sort of a riff on The Wizard of Oz. You're from Kansas, so you know that's something you know about.
Well, and it's something you know about because when you grow up in Kansas and you watch The Wizard of Oz every year, and then you leave Kansas, and the first thing that everyone says to you is, "Well, you're not in Kansas anymore, are you?" And so I had this kind of evolving relationship with the movie where I wanted to try to think about it more and more and think about what it meant. And I really fell in love with the line that Glinda the Good Witch uses when she introduces Dorothy to the Munchkins. She says, you know, "She came from above, she came very far, and Kansas," she said, "is the name of the star." And I thought, oh, well, that's just a beautiful phrase. That is the title to something. I don't know what it's the title to, but it's the title to something. And then it was great, you know, years later in working on this project to say, oh, the Eisenhower essay. I could write about Eisenhower as each of the characters in The Wizard of Oz, and I could finally use that title that I've been carrying in my back pocket for years.
And who was Eisenhower? Was he Dorothy?
He was everybody. He was the farmhands, he was Auntie Em and Uncle Henry, he was Dorothy and the Wizard and the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Cowardly Lion. He was even Toto.
Right. How was he Toto?
He was Toto in the sense of pulling back the curtain on the Wizard, which in this case was Eisenhower's farewell address, in which he famously warned against the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
And so at in the book, the little paragraph that starts Eisenhower as Toto says, "At the end, he understands. In his farewell address, he warns of the military-industrial complex, shows its machinations at work, trying to pull back the curtain. What can one small dog nipping at the heels of giants do? Even he, once a titan, is worn down by 8 years. He sees Vietnam. He is predicting here a map of Iraq, Afghanistan, more for us to discover behind the curtain."
It's so interesting how you were playful and experimental and serious, and along the way, some very deep moments emerge along with the playful moments. You open with a haunting quotation from George Washington. He says, "Where are our men of ability?" Why had that stayed with you?
It came out of this very strange notion in America of that anybody could be president, and it just needed the right person to come forward to be the right president, and to look at American history and see both how that has happened at certain points, but then how it also hasn't happened, right? The sort of double-edged sword of it is anybody can grow up to be president. The problem is that anybody could grow up to be president. And so we have this problem of sometimes the wrong person gets into office for whatever reason, right? Whether it's a political party kind of manipulating things, or if it's an accident of illness or an assassin's bullet, that it's sometimes you get this person in office who just doesn't know what to do and is overwhelmed or thinks they know what to do and makes terrible mistakes.
Were any of them particularly overwhelmed as you just looked into them?
Sure. I mean, one of the heartbreaker of the book, for me at least, is Franklin Pierce, who is just, you know, he's one of those pre-Civil War presidents that nobody kind of knows anything about except that he was president, but just was this incredibly ambitious man who really wanted to be president and really wanted to lead the country and saw himself as the right person. And then got into office, he was surrounded by tragedy. His, you know, two of his children had already died. His third child was killed in a train accident between his election and his inauguration. And his wife just retreated into mourning. He was an alcoholic, and his 4 years in the White House were just kind of marked by the country sliding ever more and more towards the Civil War. And he's tragic both for the events of his life, but also for that confidence that he had in himself, that he, yes, was, of course he wanted to be president. Of course he would be the right person. And then he was decidedly not the right person.
As you researched each of them, you got to skim American history. Mm-hmm. Did something dawn on you as you were skimming, something that you hadn't fully realized before about how American history plays out?
I feel like I should apologize to my colleagues in the history department every time I try to talk about grand sweeps like this. But it was often fascinating, and this especially was a fascinating thing to see as the book was moving towards publication after I had completed the manuscript and was at the press and being published, to watch the January 6th insurrection happen, to see how, despite rancorous differences and, you know, incredibly contested and bitter elections, that the transition had always been made, that somebody had lost the election and had stepped down, whether it was out of the tradition of you don't take more than two terms, or, you know, after the Constitution was amended, after their two terms was up, or they had lost, they always stepped down. Nobody stayed in past when they were supposed to stay. And to see that kind of transition constantly happen, and until last year happened peacefully, always felt like this kind of strange miracle that it did work, and the experiment kept going and kept succeeding in, if nothing else, transitioning who was in charge of the country.
So did you come away with your ideals intact, or are you deflated by understanding that this procession of leaders of the country were both flawed and mm-hmm. talented?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the most interesting parts of this. Was I kind of knew in beginning this project that it was going to change the way I viewed both the office of the presidency and then the people who had held the office. But I was a little surprised by the way that it humanized almost every president in one direction or another, in the sense that the people I thought of as just sort of terrible, quasi-evil, all of them had some aspect of humanity to them, right? Either whether it was something that kind of created sympathy, or if nothing else, you could just say, like, wow, that is a terrible thing that person went through. That I kind of expected. The thing I really didn't expect was, with all the presidents that I had kind of idolized and looked up to as heroes, there was always something with each one of them that tarnished that. And I think it helped me, I think by deflating my kind of idea of these heroic presidents, it let me see all of them as humans, some who were very good humans with some flaws, some who were deeply flawed with a few good points, but all of them were as human as you or me.
The last essay in your mm-hmm. collection is called Amendment, Last mm-hmm. Dance, about the dance that each new president does with their significant other to celebrate during the inauguration. Tell me about that. Why you chose to end the collection that way?
Well, it was a nice way of just rounding out the collection, in part because the collection starts with, or not quite starts with, but the Washington essay is about dancing as well, because George Washington apparently loved to dance. He and Martha would dance for long stretches at colonial balls. And in fact, even after Martha was tired out, he would dance with his officers' wives. He was a tall guy who loved dancing. So returning to the idea of the dance at the end felt like a nice way to finish the book. And it struck me that one of the strangest things about the presidency is that one of the very first things we have the president do is dance in front of us. And it's always very awkward. Even the smoothest presidents, it's still very strange to kind of watch. Here is this incredibly powerful person who just took the oath of office, who, you know, has maybe signed a few executive orders on his first day. Suddenly now, like, he's at a party and we're watching him dance as though it's, you know, this kind of homecoming ritual. And I love that idea of the president as awkward figure almost immediately, because it seems very human, right? It's like this reminder of, this is one of us doing this, right? This is a citizen of the country who, you know, wasn't born to the throne, who wasn't, you know, selected by a council, right? Who was picked by us to be the leader of us. And so finishing with the dance kind of let me get to that idea once more of, this is a human, a person who exists as a physical being with all the complications and problems of that, who we have made the most powerful person in the country and often the world.
Colin Rafferty is an English professor at the University of Mary Washington. He's also the author of Execute the Office, Essays with Presidents. In 2016, Eric Drummond Smith, a political science professor at the University of Virginia College at Wise in Appalachia, curated an exhibit at the William King Museum in Abingdon, Virginia. It was called the Cherry Bounce Show, and the idea was to round up artists from all over Appalachia to create modern artwork with one small stipulation. Each one had to be inspired by one of the presidential elections.
I began to think about kind of the romanticized early republic, when we seem to have enjoyed elections a lot more than we do these days. And yeah. and that cross-referenced this idea of modern art by Appalachians that I'm pretty passionate about. I like the idea of loving elections and celebrating democracy, no matter what our ideological preferences are, and I love the idea of Appalachians actively, and artists in general, actively reinterpreting both politics and art from the past.
Because you teach in Appalachia.
Yes, ma'am.
And the William King Museum in Abingdon, Virginia is in Appalachia. How did you go about finding enough Appalachian artists to populate this series?
That was a very exhausting, like, 2 or 3 week long process, especially because yeah. I wanted diversity. I wanted diversity of locations all over Greater Appalachia, and I wanted people from different backgrounds. I was looking to get people who were kind of working artists, like all they did was art, and then those who also were engaged more in, like, what we often think of as the intersection of art and craft, so like printmakers who work in printing presses. And I wanted people who were academic artists, who as I always said, joke, that's how you pay for the insurance, you know, and yeah. you're a teaching artist.
You ended up calling this exhibit the Cherry Bounce Show.
Yes.
What's Cherry Bounce mean?
Cherry Bounce is a kind of moonshine. It's a very, very fancy kind of moonshine. It takes a lot of work to make, apparently. I've never made it. Let me go in and clarify. And so it tended to be used in certain areas of Appalachia, like North Georgia and Western North Carolina, for the very celebratory moments, right? And election days, it was kind of very common that would be like the punch would be a cherry bounce punch in a lot of parts of the mountains.
Oh, what a cool idea. Did you manage to serve any during the exhibition?
Allegedly, there might have been some prepared and delivered by a host of different craftspeople.
Yeah.
And then one of the local bars in Abingdon, a restaurant bar that is superb, Rain, their bartender is kind of a craftsman of cocktails and designed a number of different whiskey-based cocktails that were, so they're not proper moonshine, but like bourbons, basically, and rye whiskeys that used the same kinds of processes to kind of explore the idea in a more modern context.
So after you found all these artists, you assigned each one to one of the presidential elections from the past. How many is that? 40?
Oh, golly. I'm thinking it was 43 at the time, 30, 43, 44.
And did you give them anything for background or inspiration when you said, hey, you've got Grover Cleveland, for instance?
Yes.
Yeah.
What I did, it was for each election, I did kind of a deep dive into some art associated with elections. And mostly you get a lot of posters, a lot of newspaper art, advertisements, all the way up to bumper stickers and buttons, some really funny buttons, actually. And then I also told the artists, if they wanted to do their own research, build upon what we had dug up for them, they're more than welcome to do that.
What were some of the buttons you came across that you thought were funny?
My favorite will always be Barry Goldwater buttons, because they're very, very simple. They're often like just black or white with like AuH2O. So AU, the chemical symbol for gold, H2O, water. And I don't know why I love that so much, but I love it.
Yes, because nobody would get it.
Oh, yeah, I guess. I mean, you, like a bunch of physicists and chemists were like, oh, yeah, they've got me. I still will always love the Eisenhower I Like Ike buttons.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson, man, people who didn't like Thomas Jefferson really didn't like him. And they made some pretty crazy art. Like a lot of them would refer to his sexual improprieties and his relationships with his African-American slaves. And they were very much in the open. They're in newspapers, they're in posters. But if you look at elections like in the early Republic, but really at any point, there's a lot of vitriol and almost grotesque campaign art.
It's so interesting that you're talking about politics and art. I don't normally think about art and politics as an important pairing, but really there's so much.
I feel that when we see architecture and we see great works of art, a gigantic proportion of those, historically speaking, have been about affirming or critiquing political actors. And we see it not just in the visual arts, but the musical arts, the dramatic arts. I teach Introduction to Political Philosophy. You know, the very first thing we read is the play Antigone, because I see in that, like, the beginnings of political thought in the West really are in Greek drama. And we also, if you think of like every single ancient Greek building you can think of, in some way, shape, or form is affirming some political actor or state or position. And that's true all over the world.
So tell me about some of the artists in your exhibit and what they made to depict their president or their presidential contest.
I would love to, because this is the fun part. Mira Hegese, who was, she at the time she lived in Lexington, Virginia. She's recently moved to Chicago, Illinois. But she got the election of 1912. And that, of course, is the famous election that involves the Bull Moose Party, right? And the challenge, the three-way presidential race. I believe it was Woodrow Wilson, Taft, and Teddy Roosevelt. And it turns into arguably the most intensely contested three-party election in American history. And of course, Wilson ends up winning. But what Amira did was she used printmaking and collage to create her piece. So she did some printing on pieces of acetate. I think it was acetate, a clear plastic material, and then layered it with all three presidents so that it looks like one composition until you look at it from an angle. And then you can see it breaks away and you see the three different faces pretty clearly. And then also there are different photographic montages around the edge. It's incredibly complicated and it's really, really beautiful piece.
You're actually an artist yourself and you drew Taft. Did you give yourself Taft on purpose?
I got Taft partly because I did. I probably cheated a little bit. We waited to give me what was last in order to make sure that it was, because there were a few people we were like, this race works well with their style of art. The image that stood out to me is a tobacco card, just like an old baseball card, basically. But instead of a baseball player, it's not Honus Wagner. It's a extreme close up of Taft's face, and he's got his little double chin and big cheeks that are glowing peachy red like Santa Claus on like a very beautiful like blue green background, and all it says is Bill. And it's the most charming picture ever. That was one of the things that we included for the pack, so to speak, with that election.
What does that mean, tobacco card?
When I was a kid.
Like bubble gum?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly, like a bubblegum card. So like when I was a kid, I got my baseball cards and there was bubblegum. Back in the early days of baseball cards, there were not just baseball cards, but all sorts of different, you know, politicians and historical events. But instead of bubblegum, you would have chewing tobacco or cigarettes.
Right, yeah. Of course.
I know, right? It's kind of hilarious, yeah, when you think about it.
Right.
And so I kept working on that painting forever. I painted on I used acrylic on canvas, and I did probably 5 or 6 versions of it, and I couldn't get it right. And I came into the studio one day cussing a little bit, and I looked at it and I'm like, oh, I accidentally have painted a little demon or a devil. So it ended up very different than the inspiration, but the idea became one of the juxtaposition of the way politicians present themselves, even the good ones, and the way that they often end up having to exercise power, and certainly how you have to get power, you know, and at best you're a little bit devilish in that process. And there's what's the old saying? Democracy is the worst of all systems except for all the rest. And that's what it kind of became, I guess, embedded in it subconsciously.
And tell me about the hootenanny. You also had a hootenanny on the election day of 2016.
We did. We invited some bluegrass musicians. We got some catering. And we invited press and academics and students and the community to come have a party after they voted. And that's really what we did, is we set up TVs showing all the major news networks, and we all watched the election together. And of course, as will happen with elections, some people got happier as the night went on, and some people got morose and went home. So, but I think it was really, it was a wonderful experiment in trying to have this fully communal experience with elections. It was wonderful.
Did working on the exhibit and the artwork change how you look at presidents and presidential elections?
Certainly it gave me more insight into political communication and how a huge part of how the powerful in any electoral cycle, how they communicate to the public, is not in speeches or in debates. It's in ways that are much more kind of fundamentally instinctive and visual, or just how significant those are to most people. And it also gave me a sense that we are not that radically different than our ancestors 2 centuries ago. And the connective tissue of presidential elections as this weird, it's a universal American experience, maybe the only election that's all Americans. And yet it also is experienced in different ways at different times by different people. It was surreal. So,
well, Eric Drummond Smith, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
It's been my distinct pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Eric Drummond Smith is a political science professor at the University of Virginia College at Wise. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason at Virginia Humanities. In grade school, many of us learned how the founding fathers carefully defined the office of the presidency. But my next guest says the presidency was actually shaped by ordinary people, not the political elite. Nathaniel Green is a history professor at Northern Virginia Community College and the author of The Man of the People, Political Dissent and the Making of the American Presidency.
Well, it's certainly true that early presidents and early political thinkers thought a lot about the presidency. But it's also true that people outside of the presidency who would never be president also thought a great deal about the office as well. And more to the point, they argued viciously over what they thought was happening to the country or would happen to the country. It's conflict, not consensus, that really makes the presidential office. And it's conflict that really creates America, in a sense. It's conflict is this defining